What is up, everybody? Welcome to Too Much Information with Sean Arnold. I am Sean Arnold this week. Thank you, sir. My guest tonight is a friend of for 20-something years, a long time.
Yeah, sort of that 20.
Yeah, a long time. He is a professional musician, a professional bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
Has been playing everywhere for a long time. One of my favorite musicians also, too. Music I listen to all the time. My good buddy, Wes Yoakam.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So the reason, and Wes is in the house, literally in the house.
Literally.
Normally we do these things on Skype, but I had to abuse our friendship and have you come over and show me how to work all these fucking electronics.
Yeah, the demon electronics. Yeah, I've fought my battles with them many, many, many times, so... If I can share anything, I'm always glad to.
You can appreciate this because one of the things that I think is so compelling about your music for me is that there is, not all the time, I mean, not just for the sake of having stuff, but with intention, there is usually quite a number of things going on. Like, I think I've always told you that I imagine that you think in lots of levels.
Yeah, I think I've always envisioned songs as like a Swiss clock with lots of turning gears.
Yeah.
And that's why I love things like arpeggiators and different little sounds, repeating riffs that come in and float out. Kind of like the Tears of Fears we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
Where things come in and out, but I'm a Ronnie Spector kind of mixer. I like that wall of sound. Yeah. I'm always impressed when I hear like a rap album and there's like a bass line and a very simple drum beat. And that's the whole thing.
And it's enough.
Maybe one sound effect, yeah, that comes in every once in a while.
And it's enough.
Yeah.
You know?
And even a good certain rock mixes will sound that way, too. It's like the way a three-piece, like The Police, can sound like 75 people.
You know? Yeah. And I think from a recording standpoint, though, one of the things that for me is it feels like there are lots of things that are, it's a certain amount of attention to detail, right? Like from a standpoint of, and again, maybe I'm hearing things that aren't there. Maybe I've put you on such a pedestal that I'm hearing things that aren't there. But, you know, it's just like if you've got a song, because clearly, conceptually, any song can be broken down into like, here are the chords and here's the melody and here's the lyrics.
Right.
But then when you start to compose, right, when you start to compose it for a recorded track, you know, I just feel like there are circumstances where you've got like, there's just a three-note guitar run that just shows up in this part of the song, and it's there for a real reason, right? Like, right. I want to bring this out, or there's a certain, there's a feeling I'm going for here, or, you know, there are notes that want to take this piece to another place. Because there's clearly lots of people that don't do that. They just bang their chords out, you know, they sing.
That's true. Yeah.
But you know, it just seems like you have a number of songs, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Well, I think anybody that's real, like, listen to somebody like maybe Johnny Marr and Morrissey kind of thing, the Smiths. Johnny Marr has this brilliant counterpoint lines to what Morrissey does melodically with the vocal line. And that's what you've got to have. And sometimes, you know, within the chord strum, you know, you sort of hear a melody. And maybe as you're recording, you might just double that melody with a one line. The thing that you're hearing that's inside the chord, you may double that just to bring that out and emphasize that little counter melody that's sort of automatically happening in the way the chords' voices are changing. Which is why chord voicing is so important, because like having a third in the top makes a chord sound totally different than having the fifth in the top or having the fundamental. And then obviously if you put something like, you know, a suspended figure in the top or a sixth or something, then you get this tension. And so that overlying tension or the underlying resolution in the counter melody is like, those things all have to work together. But I've heard tracks where a lot of people just put in a lot of stuff in a thing.
Yeah.
And that's also a fast way to make, like, that's the way I cook. I put a bunch of stuff in a bowl, and I mix it together. And then I try to just eat as fast as I can and get back to whatever else I'm doing. You know, that's pretty much my cook. And now people mix that way, or they record that way. And it's like, yeah, you've got 40. But I think at that point, too, the editing process is big. Because
sure.
Nowadays, I mean, you know, back in the day of the Beatles, it was really interesting. I heard a Beatles tribute band, but it was interesting even as they went through their progression as a tribute band, listening to the Beatles songs from the early days of like the 9-hour amphetamine driven, you know, set music to their later dreamier studio created set stuff. I mean, that's a very different way of writing, but you've got to be able to edit because nowadays, you have the unlimited capacity to add on as many tracks as you want. The tracks volume, the expensive tape is not there. The boards can all handle it because we've all got digital, you know, stuff now. I mean, that's the amazing thing of the digital age. But now it's almost the too much information. It's like now we can save everything and we don't have to make a choice till the very end. But then you have 1,000 choices in your final mix, whereas 20 years ago, you basically had about 3 or 4 in a sense. You know what I mean? There were things that were close. But.
Hence the name of the podcast, Too Much Information.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going for here.
It all ties in.
That's right. Good callback.
That's
that you
professionalism
didn't
right
to
there.
That's why you hated playing with me so much, because you played a chord and I would just play the exact same chord right on top of it.
The best stuff we did is when we vamped around. You were down here and I was move around. Because you're right, there really is nothing worse, though. Have you ever seen an acoustic duo where both guys are hitting the same chord? No. The worst thing in the musical world, and I mean this, and I want to emphasize, I really mean this, is the duo piano player thing, where both guys are playing two different bass lines, and so down on the left hand, it's just two guys, it just sounds like a monster crashing through the door.
Yeah.
Crash, because there's nothing coherent. Maybe the other stuff in the top end kind of can blend and roll around each other. That's the worst thing in the world.
I think, though, in those situations, like if you did go to like a dueling piano or something, the problem is most of those times those guys can really play.
Yeah.
But the problem is that they don't have a great concept of playing with someone else, and they're just trying to outdo each other.
Well,
and it turns into a mess.
It quickly.
Yeah.
And if you're like a classical, I mean, and I have a lot of classical friends that are great, but most classical players, when they get in with the band, want to play a full, they don't want to stay in there. I mean, arrangement, a mix is, I'm going to play this little part in this sonic range, and you're going to play this part, and they're going to interact in this way. But when you've got a piano with the dynamic range of the full piano, which is essentially the whole range of human hearing, and you can do anything, then they're used to creating a Chopin, you know, here's my orchestral kind of mix, and they're playing all over the band. The bass player's trying to play and the guy's hamming it up on the left hand, you know. The guitar strummer is playing his thing, and there's this piano just sort of overlaid all over everything, and it's chaos. And I see that a lot. A really good player obviously knows what you're talking about, is to kind of balance off each other where a bunch of little parts get turned into this magnificent whole.
Yeah, and I think it's also about time
with a W.
Right. Right. There's also time and place though, because one of the things that I've struggled with, because I most of my playing career has been a whole lot of acoustic cover gigs, a lot of them solo.
Yeah.
And you know this as well as anyone, because you still do this. You're the whole show, right? And so I play acoustic guitar aggressively and percussively.
Yeah.
Because when you don't have other people, that sense of rhythm, that backbeat, you know, you can do that with your right hand playing the guitar. And it's almost necessary. You can't just clean strum in a bar gig, right? It doesn't, it's not, I mean, you can, but I think it's more impactful for the audience if you've got some percussion just based on how you're playing your acoustic. It's been a challenge for me trying to play electric because I'm too heavy handed, because you don't have to do that when you're playing electric.
You got to play a lot less.
Yeah.
When you pull up an electric sound, you know, a few power chords, but then you got to play double note or two note lines, things like that. Yeah. Because you start crunching down on like you would play an acoustic, a Les Paul distortion. There's just,
but you don't have to do anything, and I make it harder on myself, right? Because you just have to hit the notes, right? The electronics and everything does the work for you, whereas with an acoustic, you're actually also creating sound, right? Like by how hard you play.
Sure, and even though your pickups are still picking it up, but there is an intensity that you're putting into it. I mean, that's a great thing about acoustic guitar, though, too, is it's essentially a tuned drum, really.
Yes,
and so you have that built-in percussion. And yeah, if you're trying to sum a mix of like a full band with guitars and bass and, drums, obviously, and everything else and five different, things, layers of percussion, you've got to have that element. Sometimes I hear some guys especially doing the cover thing, they'll play technically the right guitar part. This is the guitar part that was played on the album. But it by itself sounds kind of like just nothing really, because it's counterpointing. It's the trick is to try to sum it up and boil it down to all the essential elements. Here's a line that's got to come out here, but then the bass line's important on the verse and a little more emphasis on that. And You know, then like you said, the percussion element, if you don't have that side of it, you're not going to get anybody
very
excited about your set for very long.
Yeah, it's funny too. Like, I've actually been able to sort of re-experience songs because for so many years there were songs that I had in my cover sets that I really liked. And that's the thing about cover gigs, especially if you're someone like me, which is an average to slightly below average guitar player. Again, like I tell people all the time, if you put me in a party in the neighborhood,
okay,
I'm really good. If I went to hang out with you and a bunch of our other friends, I'm the mentally handicapped stepkid.
And both of us, we put in a special bus. We went to play with Tommy Emmanuel. You know, there's always that next level of just like, oh my.
But I always, Lord, though, I like that. And that's one of the reasons why I always enjoy it, because I learned a lot just from hanging out with people. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and I'm fine with it because I'm not trying to make my living or anything. You know, it was something for me that I loved and I just started doing. But the thing that's interesting is, like, you do break songs down, because in those kind of gigs, you're playing the chords. You know, now the technology allows a lot different, because if someone goes to see one of your shows now, you know, you've got a harmonizer for your vocal that you can throw in when you need to. You've got a pedal board. You've got a loop station where you can, and for those of you that don't know what a loop station is, you can play something on the acoustic, hit a timer to start it. You know, just play the root chords and hit it again, and then that'll play behind, and you can solo, so it doesn't just stop. So you just look like an idiot standing up there playing solo lines over the top of so if there's only one guy, you can get like a recorded loop of something you played before to play over the top. But you know, again, that's way too complicated for someone at my skill level. So anyway, one of the songs I was thinking of was Champagne Supernova. You know, that song by Oasis.
Of course.
So I play that song all the time. It's one of my favorite songs to play, but I do it really basically, and I did for years and years, and I can't remember the last time I listened to the real song.
Right.
And I went and listened to it, and it's like, oh my God, there's a lot of stuff going on in here.
Oh, there's like bird whistles and bird chirps.
But even the guitar, like the melody runs and stuff that are in there, that when you're just playing, you know, like you're just playing the chords, you know, and it's almost like I've replaced the real track with that track that I do in my head, because you have to go reproduce it. You know what I mean? And you do it over and over again. And it's really interesting. And another thing that's been really crazy is, believe it or not, there's this thing on Xbox called Rocksmith. Have you heard of this thing?
I've seen like the signs for it in the video store.
So what's crazy about it is that, it's not like, Guitar Hero or whatever, where you know you've got a plastic thing that's just got buttons.
Right,
it's got an actual, you plug in a real guitar, and what it does is it actually will take you, and it starts and it scrolls you through and shows you the actual for real chord progressions or note progressions for songs.
Okay,
and it takes you through whole notes, and then once you get your accuracy level up, it starts adding notes until you get to the end, and it's every note that's on the studio track,
okay,
played as it's played on the thing. And you clearly have to be able to master before it moves you up. So some of those things I'll never be able to play, because they've got songs on there that are just like, you know, that are like guitar gods playing, you know, 64th notes. You know, I'm like never gonna play that.
Steve I or something.
Yeah, but what's crazy is, even looking at that, like, I don't think people understand sonically, like, which is okay. But if you really want to break songs down, there's often things going on underneath you don't actively hear, but it's part of the experience. But when you hear it in that thing on like a Rocksmith, it's like, holy crap, I didn't even know that this guitar part was in here, you know, that this was going on. But now I kind of hear it and I understand why it's there, but it didn't jump out.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, and sometimes if you listen to the same song through different speakers, I'm sure you've had this, like all of a sudden you hear a different part that you didn't notice before, or like, you know, in an extreme case, like, you know, a song when they were experimenting with stereo where everything, the guitar solo is totally on the left and the rhythm track is totally on the right. But if you've always listened to it in stereo, you know, but you go in like a restaurant or something where one side's either off for whatever reason, or you just can't hear it. You know, all of a sudden you're like, hear this echo of like the rhythm guitar track. You're like, wow, okay. I see how that fundamentally provides like harmonic support and sort of a skeleton that the solo is bouncing off of. And it, you know, it's funny, those little parts made a big difference. You remember the band called The Grapes?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we were first getting going, we did a bunch of shows with them, went through Colorado with them, and great guys, a 6-piece band, I think, at the time. And they had one guy, and I think his name was, God, I want to say his name was Rahman, something like that.
Could have been.
But he was the rhythm guitar player that stood right in the center, hair over his face, never looked like he was doing much of anything. And but when they got rid of him, I guess they thought the same thing, we could save some money. It was never the same. There was something fundamentally missing in the whole of that band, in the center of that band, that him just doing whatever he was doing, which never, again, didn't seem like much, it made a huge difference. And it was the sound of the band. That's the same thing with the mix, you know, that one little part.
But that's the thing. It's almost, though, that in some cases in music, it's not, it's like, it's not something you hear, but if it wasn't there, you would know it wasn't.
Or just, yeah, it wouldn't feel as good.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's always the thing I've said about really amazing rhythm sections. And I'm not talking about, you know, there's clearly circumstances where you've got, you know, John Bonham or Neil Peart or somebody where, like, you can hear them play. But really good rhythm sections, a lot of the time, it's like you don't really notice them. And then, you know, but if you took them out, you would, or put somebody that was bad in the place of one of them, it would really make a difference. This is what I tell people all the time about Duran Duran. Okay, because you think of that as the synthy sort of pop, you know what I mean, whatever.
Yeah, Nick Rhodes doing her arpeggiator stuff over big string patches.
But I'm talking about, if you never find, go on to Google sometime and look at ISO for John Taylor.
He's bad.
Oh, my God. Bad. Like, there is some bass stuff going on in there that you would never in a million years associate with Duran Duran.
Yep.
Like, go listen to the bass line for Rio. Go listen to the bass line for Rio. Because you don't even pick that up when you're listening to Rio. But if you listen to it by itself, it's like, who is this dude?
Yeah. No, it has a totally, and it's a different, and that's a different thing, you know, where if he was playing, and that's what you're getting to is a little bit the chemistry of a band too, because that bass player playing those busy lines in a band with busy guitar playing too.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Or a busy synth player. Because one thing Nick Rhodes did on the keyboards, he was doing a lot of Jones, and the tone was actually going, kind of doing a fade. And then he had arpeggiators doing kind of thing. But he actually did a lot of static chords, and a lot of the rhythmic interest of that thing was the bass line. And you're exactly right. My friend Tigger from 5'8" sent that over one time. I was like, listen to this. I was like, no kidding. I was, that's the, because like, Duran Duran in my neighborhood, I mean, if you were a book guy, you could not admit that you listened to Duran Duran. But I had every, you know, I had every cassette. Yeah. I was totally, it was bad to the bone. I loved it, you know.
Yeah, there's actually a thing going around now. I put it on my Facebook page a while back. I'll actually link it in the comments if you guys want to find it. It's, but it's a radio show out in LA, and apparently they do this on the regular, and I want to find more of them. But one of the guys is a former musician. And he gets, I guess, somehow access to the audio files for a lot of songs. Okay. And they go down and he ISOs everything. And then they take like 18 or 20 minutes on their radio show and they go by and sort of break songs down part by part.
Okay.
And they talk about, you know, some of the pieces. So they broke down Rosanna by Toto.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Okay.
So things I didn't know, and listen to this, which again goes to band. So apparently all the guys in Toto were all these studio musicians in L.A.
Yeah.
And people would come in and always, like, I think it was Neil Pecoro, the drummer, that apparently was just like this mega badass. And they were always doing sessions together because people were bringing them in. And they were sitting around one day and they're like, why don't we have a band? Like, people are always hiring us to play on stuff. Why don't we just have a band? And that's how Toto got started.
I didn't know that. So I knew they were session players, but it makes sense.
So it's all these psychopathic. So they take Rosanna and they break it down. And it's just like, holy. But it speaks to that because they go do all the pieces because there's keys, there's bass, there's drums, there's a million harmonies. You know, they've got like a five-part harmony, which is that Vincent's gone since you went away. There's like five guys singing that little breakdown part.
There's like a big bass.
Yeah, there's a bass guy in there, like almost like barbershop quartet style. But that dude too adds, there's the horns.
Yeah.
Right? And they do it all, but when you hear them by themselves, it's like, man, these guys can all really jam.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's, but then when you put it all together, Rosanna's this huge song, right? Like, from a not huge popular, I mean, it's big. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, horns, strings.
But it's not muddy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not like you're like, oh my God, like, it works. Like, the way they do it, it makes a lot of sense. But that's normally a song, too. Like, that's a band I think people kind of snicker and roll their eyes at. And they're like, oh, like, I'll listen to Africa in my car, but I would never, like, you know, put it on at a party.
Yeah. I don't know. I just, a funny one. That's one of my wild card songs. Like,
I love
I'll
that
just
song.
Pull it out in the middle of a set. Maybe play some serious stuff and just throw it, and all of a sudden people go crazy. So,
you know what mine was? Genie in a Bottle.
Okay.
By Christina Aguilera.
Nice.
Guaranteed to make people lose their minds.
Yeah.
Because it takes them a good 20 seconds to just figure out what's going on.
What the heck is this?
Or that's like the rap thing. So we did that the other night. Like, that's an interesting phenomenon. So Wes was playing at Old Vining's Inn a couple weeks ago, which he does on the reg. And also Limerick Junction. So he's still out and about. So if you find yourself on a random night wanting to go out and listen to some really good live music, go see him at Limerick.
Yeah.
I love rap music, and you know what, and it's funny because this was I think a lot of people are right, think it was when the Gourds, that band the Gourds, did that version of Gin and Juice where they like almost bluegrass Gin and Juice.
Yeah.
I was doing the rap thing long before the Gourds did that, but I just did it because I knew all the words. I didn't have to sing it because, again, like, I'm an okay singer, not great, you know.
People go crazy when you do that.
They went nuts.
Time.
I mean,
back in the day when we used to play together back at.
It's just amazing because they just don't expect it.
Yeah, I think that's it.
But it goes back to, but anyway, so you and I give you lots of credit. Like, you had the Dr. Dre song or the Snoop song that you had mixed into your set, which I think is a brilliant move because the crowd's at a place where you're playing out like that drinking. That's the kind of thing you want to do.
Yeah, and wild card, just, wow, what?
Actually didn't have, the reason when you first asked me to come up and I was like, no, is I was just like, number one, I was like, can I still pull this off? And then number two, it's like, do people really want to hear that? Because I love, you know, your stuff, and I'm like, God, he's so good. And then I'm going to get up there like a moron and start like
rapping.
No, I
freaking love it, man.
And
it's
they
a different
just,
level. It's a totally different level.
They just lose their minds.
Yeah, every time. No, it's funny, dude. I've seen, it works. And it's, but, you know, I think that's the thing, too, that, again, and a lot of entertainers kind of miss is they stay at one level all night. And even if they're really, I've heard a lot of really good guys who are like, man, musically they're nailing it, but just informationally I've gotten the same thing for an hour, you know, that kind of thing. And it's but something like that, you throw that in there, everybody's like, it shakes people up, it gets them going, like, oh wow, yeah, it's something totally different, you know. And that's in live entertainment, that's what it should be, whether you're doing all originals or covers or you're doing a theater production or whatever, or an opera, it really is all the same game, or you're having a church sermon.
Yeah,
it's
well,
all the same.
It's a lot like serving a meal, right? Like, if you ever sit down for like a chef's course or whatever, you know, where you don't order and they just bring stuff out, there's a like, you know, you're not going to get like a super spicy dish, and then right behind it you're going to get another thing that's like flavor out the wazoo, and then right behind that you're going to get like, it's going to take you on this, you know, it's going to take you on a journey where it's going to move you around, you know what I mean? And that's how I feel like any gig should be, right? It's there's a pace, and you have to change the pace.
Well, it's like any good. Well, back when people used to listen to such things as albums,
yes,
it's spelled A L B U.
Is there a Z in there somewhere?
Probably. just for the angry kids who have no idea what that is. Originally, artists had a whole thought.
Yeah, the songs were in a certain order. Yeah.
It wasn't just a 3-minute thought, you know. And you made an album like that. But you didn't have an album full of singles. You had albums that. You know, in my always favorite song, it seemed like the number 4th or 6th song in an album, we're like, this is the totally where the band said, okay, we've given you producer and record company, we gave you your singles and a ballad, but here's what we're going to do, what we want to do, and here's something really unique and different. And that's where you find some of the deep tracks. I mean, that's where you find the really interesting stuff where people branch out of their sort of formula, because you got to have that formula because the record company demands it and radio demands it and your career demands it. And your kids want to get fed, so I get all that. But it's great to get to that 6th track on an album or 7th track where the band can really do something a little more experimental and take some chances.
Yeah, so Super.
Which people don't do nowadays as much because it's just single, single, single. It's a different mindset, I think. I'm not saying people don't make albums, so they certainly do, but there's definitely an emphasis on the single side of it rather than...
There is.
Making a big piece of art.
There is, and there's that idea of a... Like, to your point, like an album being a thing, like one of my, honestly, like, I love technology. I work in technology. I think it's great. But my fucking, oh my God, one of my biggest pet peeves on the fucking planet Earth with all these audio things now is where they insert space between tracks on purpose all the time. So I don't know if you ever listen, but if you go and queue up an album on Spotify, they put like 3 seconds between tracks always. So when it's moving from one track to the next, it's physically switching tracks. But it just adds some buffer or whatever.
Okay.
So one of my favorite musical experiences listening to an album in the world is on Purple Rain, when it goes from I Would Die For You into Baby I'm a Star.
Okay.
It's a separate track. There is no space. Right at the end of, you know, it goes in that, you know, Baby I'm a Star, right? It's that aggressive drum thing. Because the other thing about Purple Rain that's so badass is like half that record was recorded live. Right. So, which is even more mind boggling when you listen to some of the shit going on in there. Like the fact that he was just playing it at whatever in Minneapolis and they had a truck that they recorded.
But you also hear that energy.
You do.
You can beat out of a song faster than anything with multi-tracking. But anyway, I'm listening.
But point is, don't put a space there. Right. Like the intent when the artist created the record. Was your there are spaces between all the other songs. There's not a space between those two tracks. Yeah. That's on purpose, asshole. Like, he didn't do that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that wasn't an accident where somebody forgot to track out some uptime between I Would Die For You and Baby I'm a Star. It goes into it immediately on purpose.
Well, that's what you do a set, too. You play song and song, and you have two songs that go together. Then maybe you do a three-song medley, then song that ends, songs that ends, fast song, slow song. Maybe at the end, you either do your biggest hit or you do a little medley or something. But yeah, you know, that's part of, and that's showmanship. I mean, that's stagemanship and putting together a set. That's the only thing you really learn that, you know, as you know, when you've been out there and you've played a couple, few hundred gigs and all of a sudden things start to go, okay, yeah. That worked here and I can take this from there like a comedy act. You know, this joke killed, this joke kills, this joke that I think is hilarious is crap. It never hits, you know, and that's the way you put a song together, a set together, an album together.
It's also such a function of the crowd, and that's the other thing that I don't think people realize is whatever plan you had going in, a lot of times you can just throw out the window because it's going to totally depend on whether, how people, if they're with you, if they're not, if they're, you know what I mean? Like, because
what mood they're in.
Absolutely.
You ever played like when the Braves, back when the Braves started getting big for the first time? I remember we were on pins and needles. It was like, oh, man, because if they lose, this bar's going to empty out. People are going to be sullen and bitter. And, you know, P.O. You know, but I mean, and you can't take the primitive element out of people or music or anything that relates to people in music. Because of all my, you're talking about the pedals are like the looper, the harmonizer, the eight pedals I have, the bass sub pedal, the chorus, two delays, blah, 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 blah. The most important pedal, the one that I really can't get without, is the kick drum pedal that I trigger. Because once that beat is going,
people start nodding their heads.
Then it's they can feel it, and then you can start doing acoustic lines over the beat to where even if you didn't have the looper with the extra chords underneath, you could still have that. And because people are, that's the fundamental, is the ugh, grab girl by hair, you know. I mean, that is, and we haven't changed from that, not fundamentally in you know, 50,000 years.
Well,
years,
I'm about to get really deep on you too now about, because I love music. But the other thing too is that there are biochemical reactions, right, to music. Sure. I mean, like when you get a tingling sensation, everybody's had that where someone hits a note.
Where are you getting this sensation?
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, that was what we were doing in the 90s was something else. But you know what I mean? You're listening, somebody hits a big note or they hit normally too. Like usually it's a minor note and all that somewhere. Sure. And it's a mostly major song. And then here comes that minor and you feel that back of your neck. Like, sure. There's an emotional part to a lot of that because the artist has made a good decision, but there is actually also some chemistry that's going on,
sure,
right? Where that particular frequency triggers a certain response. And a lot of those times, you know, those things are done for real reasons. But to your point, the percussive nature of it, like I think that there is a physical reaction to music outside of just hearing it and going, oh, I like that song.
No, they're cool. I mean, there's always been studies and, I'm not going to speak to the veracity of these stories, but I've always heard the story about how the shape of a women's hips actually resonates with certain bass frequencies more. And I don't know if it's true, but I can see that. But certainly our physiology plays a huge part in how we interpret music, first of all. And then also sort of a, there's a, I mean, you know, drums were used in armies for, I mean, they you hear somebody riding down the street thumping their bass at 3 a.m. it's there's something that almost feels a little bit aggressive about it.
Yes.
Because it is an aggressive act. It's I am dominating this area with sound and with big, powerful sound that sounds like big animals or something, in the way that thunder scares your dog, or a big big bassy truck going by will make your dog. That sounds like a huge animal trying to get me.
Oh, that's a great analogy with the thunder.
That's the same thing that we feel. And so you try to create that power in a double rock. I mean, a huge rock band with heavy metal band with double kick drum. I mean, what could be more, you know, indicative than that? The guy with the double kick drum and then the bass player with the bottom, you know, five string bass where it just, you know, it just hits you and just right into your area.
My first experience with that when I must have been 17. I snuck into the Masquerade to see Radiohead.
Cool.
Before Radiohead was really Radiohead.
Yeah.
And
Pablo Honey somewhere in there.
It was right before Creep, really, sort of.
Okay.
You know, so 92.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I stood right in front of Johnny Greenwood, and it was like a religious experience.
Yeah,
I mean, he had those orange stacks, and he's just a monster anyway. And not from a play, but just he gets amazing tones, and he does interesting things. And but you know, it was just like this. I felt like I was standing in front of a you know, like it was washing over me, right? Like I just felt like it was what he was doing, and I could hear him because I was so close that I was actually. I think the way the Masquerade was set up, I was actually behind the mains.
Okay.
You know, because they're up high. Right. They were up high to the right and left of the stage, and I was so close to the stage. So basically I was hearing the natural drum sounds and his amps. And it was just like, what is happening right now?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's, I think, one of the big things that really got me going in music was that experience.
I can see he's nuts to watch him play. He's bending over, messing with his pedals as much to make effects and things happen, and sweeping his delays. So he gets you know, kind of crazy effects. Yeah, I've seen them a few times. Well, that's also the great thing about seeing, and I've almost gotten to the point now where, like, seeing a band and, like, the Enormo Dome, I just don't. Because it sounds like garbage. It sounds like you're listening to the band through a PA. Almost like the record, but like when you go see a band in like the 529 or the Earl, where you there's a PA and you're getting that reinforcement, so it sounds big, but you can really hear the amps and the acoustic sound of the drums and things. That's a totally different level of hearing, and you hear the harmonics, not just the harmonies, but actually the harmonics of the amps and the way it all works together, and that is. Where so many bands, you just lose it at a bigger venue. You know?
Yeah, I feel like it's somewhere around maybe 3,000 seats if it's done right. Where I feel like, because there are definitely like some like Roxy shows back in the day, Tabernacle shows that just blew my mind, right? Because it's still, you still got all that. It still was intimate. But like, you know, I'm a huge U2 fan, and I went to that first time in the Dome U2 concert. Okay. You know, that was the first concert they ever had in the Georgia Dome.
Okay.
And that's a good ass band, obviously.
Yeah.
It couldn't have sounded worse.
Really?
And it just really, it was so disappointing because, and I knew it wasn't them. I mean, fortunately, you know, but it's just like, this is not how, I don't think this is how music was intended to be consumed.
No, I don't think it was. And I think, too, as you get, it's sort of a snake eating the tail kind of thing. Like, I think when you get that big, like, look at what Coldplay, their first album, was this really stripped-down, beautiful, gorgeous album. And I like their continue-on stuff, but it's a very different sound. But you get in those big venues, and I think you're looking for something because I'm to fill that space, which is where you get a lot of those keyboard backing tracks, and all of a sudden you start to feel normal again because you have that feeling of that sound around you, which you can get in a smaller venue with four guys and four amps, and, you know, you get that full sound if your arrangements are right. And I think I remember playing just a few times that we played like a bigger shed, like Lakewood or Oakwood Mountain, whatever, Oak Mountain Amphitheater.
Yeah.
And it just, you're outside, there's no reflection off the walls. You just, it's like you hit your guitar and it just is like, I almost hear something coming out way over there. Yeah. And it's a surreal kind of thing. And it's, all of a sudden your band sounds very empty compared to what you're used to. And I see why bands kind of, as they get bigger, all of a sudden it's like, we got to add this and add this and these three
things. It's the same way with lights and video, which I actually am not a huge fan. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I understand why people, but that's part of it too, right? You're, now you're trying to create a visual experience. And like, I just want to watch, you know, people play. That's why I think that it's, we, you know, again, it's, we're old, right? So we're kind of get off my lawn people at this point to a degree, because we're just like, oh man, but
you kids and your damn rap music.
Two summers ago, we went to Chastain to see Heart, which is, I love. And I mean, there wasn't Jack, there was no fucking lights. There wasn't anything. Yeah. Like, they just came out and just were like, we're about to melt faces.
Yeah.
Because Ann Wilson is, to me, maybe the greatest female rock vocalist of all time.
She had a hell of a voice. They did some, I hate it when they got into the really schmaltzy stuff.
Yeah,
when
she was
singing like Barracuda and some of that crap.
Oh, but then what was crazy, did you see the Kennedy Center honors when they had them do Stairway for when they inducted Led Zeppelin into the Kennedy Center? Holy shit, dude. Everyone Google that, right? So they played with, and actually Jason Bonham, John Bonham's son, came out and played with them.
Yeah.
And they just did Stairway. Dude, Robert Plant fucking cried. Seriously, like, they cut to him up in the balcony and he's full on crying. And it's like, all I got to say is, if someone asks you to, first of all, if anybody ever asked me to come play Stairway, I would say no. Yeah. If they said, no, come play Stairway at Kennedy Center, I'd be like, hell no. Come play Stairway at Kennedy Center in front of Led Zeppelin, I would be like, fuck you, I'm moving to Canada.
Yeah,
right?
Triple
like,
dog, no.
Yeah. And so, but like, that's something, right? If you can impact that guy. Right.
Sure.
Who, that song probably just one of those songs to a degree has been a bit of a bane, because it's become such a, it's one of the greatest rock songs I think ever written, but it's so it's become such a huge piece of pop culture
it's Freebird in a way.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, they did it. So when they came to Chastain, Jason Bonham has the band called the Led Zeppelin Experience, where he plays and they have other guys and they just do Zeppelin covers. So they played with them. So they came out first and they did a bunch of the sort of minor to mid Zeppelin stuff. Heart played, and then the encore was everyone on stage, including Jason Bonham, and they did like four Zeppelin tunes.
Okay.
With Ann Wilson singing lead on them. And it was otherworldly. I mean, it was just really awesome. But it was no,
that sounds really cool.
No frills, dude. It was just like, here we go. You know what I mean? Like, and I've had a crush on Nancy Wilson since I was 10 years old.
She still is beautiful.
Amazing.
Like, super beautiful.
And I think her and Cameron Crowe got divorced, so you're telling me there's a chance. Sorry, Holly.
One in a million, so you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, I'd like to see that, actually. That sounds pretty
good. You have to look it up. It's one of those things, too, like, just, like, musically, it's so good that it's, and the way they chose to do it, like from a production standpoint, because there's some choral stuff they do. There's a choir, you know, at parts. Like, it wasn't over. It was one of these. They had some ideas about how to get to it, and it was really well done.
I'll look that up. That's I mean, that's one thing. I mean, to do Robert Plant, there aren't too many singers that can really.
No.
And I mean, she and sometimes when a woman's voice tries to come in, you think, oh, natural. That's her in her range, but the whole thing that made it sound good is that pushing and that screaming of a Robert Plant to get up to those seriously crazy high notes. But she's got that quality, that raspy, like, I've sung 5,000 gigs, you know, I've been around. You hear that in somebody's voice. You hear that as much as the notes they sing, the, you know, what they put into it. I mean, you can just hear the depth of voice. That's where I lose, like, the voice. There's just, it's a pretty voice, but there's just no character. There's a thousand smoky bar gigs that have to happen before you can do anything interesting with your voice, I think, or at least 500, somewhere in there. There's a threshold where you get past being just an amateur and maybe being past a mid-level player, and then you've got some experience. Even if you're not great, because I'm certainly not anywhere near the greatest guitar player, not even close, not even in Atlanta, but I've learned enough things to hang, and things that always work, and things that can work in a bad sound situation, in a good sound situation, things that'll make people's adrenaline go, ah, you know, and those things. And that's what you got to, I mean, that's how you got to play and be, and you've got to have that in your set, and you've got to have that in your sound. And that's where I think so much we're getting now is just this sort of C-level, boring, kind of same old, everybody's listening to the same producer package kind of sound, and everything's compressed to the hilt, so
yeah,
every whisper vocal sounds like it's screaming at you, and you're like, oh my God, my head hurts because I haven't had a dynamic in, you know, four songs now. So it's just a different thing, and I think people will learn how to use these tools and all that, but I think it's still a development thing. And there's something, I think that's why a lot of people are going retro, because there is a sound to a great band that wasn't just put together in the studio.
Well, there's speaking of that, with guitar, you're right, but also with your voice, I think there's also a point as a singer where you have to find your own voice. That I think is harder for a guy like me who didn't really do tons of originals.
Right.
Because you're a lot of the times not even consciously, you're just sort of trying to somewhat mimic what you're hearing, like with intonation and you know what I mean? And pitch and all those things. It's like, hey, I'm just going to try to see if I can reproduce this guy. Yeah. Right. Like if I'm doing a Coldplay song, I'm going to sound kind of mumbly and have those sort of rounded points or whatever. And then if I'm going to sing Oasis, I'm going to try to sound Beatly and a little more nasally. And then if I'm going to sing, you know what I mean? Right. Like, so
yeah, you find places in your voice, different colors, your voice,
as opposed to just going, well, what do I sound like? Right. Like if I wrote a song, what do I sound like?
Right.
And that takes time. Sometimes it takes a lot of time.
Yep.
And it's something, it took me a long time to get to where it's like, okay, well, if I'm just going to sing for me, this is what I sing like.
Right.
Right. And, but also too with singing, it's funny with people because my game was, I was like 20% ability and like 80% entertainment. Okay. Like that, but that's fine. Right. Like that was my deal. Like you're going to have a good time. Right. Like if you put a four track, attached it to the board and played it back later and sent it to someone, they would be like, someone pays this guy to sing. But
that's not true, but I know what you're saying.
But in the, but no, but I mean, but in that environment, I was good at that. You know what I mean? Like because I was able to let people have a good time, but with singing too, like there's almost an element of confidence that's 100% necessary, because when I first started monkeying around, I was really self-conscious because I had no training. I sang in the car, I sang in the shower. I started to play the guitar and would sing in my apartment because it's like, if you're playing, I feel like I need to be singing. And there was a point at some place where I was like, dude, just go for it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you just got to go for it.
Just get past it, yeah.
And just go. Because if you're, like, this holding back being thing, it's not. And then if you're not good enough, you know what I mean? You won't get any jobs or you won't get any gigs. And, you know, but then you can keep playing in your apartment. And that's fine, too. But, you know, but it's like there's that, I think, confidence in most things in life, especially in art. It's really noticeable when it's not there. I mean, you've just got to be willing to go for it.
And even if you can hear three people sing the same song, maybe it's a cover song, but they can start, you know, but you can tell the person who's been around and sung has got, now every once in a while, there's that old soul voice, you know, and that's the thing that you can't buy, sell. Somebody like Michael Stipe, who can literally read lyrics off of he was reading out of a book and that was part of the lyric. You know, but his voice is something about the way he put words together, the way his voice sounded in conjunction with what the other band was doing. It's that, you know, I mean, can you imagine Michael Stipe singing for Toto? Like we're talking about.
Yes. No, of course not.
You know, it'd be ridiculous. I mean, but, and that's part of finding your own voice. And when somebody who finds their own voice also finds their own band, whether they can create all the instruments and do that and direct others, or if it's a U2, REM, Zeppelin, The Police, Beatles, and you'll notice how much coincidence is in all the greatest bands in the world.
Yeah.
And there really is. I mean, there's a magic that happens sometimes, or it doesn't happen. And that's the only thing you can't learn. You can develop magic a little bit. You can develop it, certainly, and take a... but if you don't have that magic quality in your voice or in your playing... there really is, you can only work so hard. And I've watched so many talented guys, and I'm sure, I know you have too, that are so good, but just didn't have that one little piece. Either the group they were with wasn't right, or maybe something in their voice just didn't have that voice to move 10,000 people. Some people have a voice to move 50 people. Some people have a voice to move a million people. You know, and it's very subjective, but it's also very built around timing. It's built around the skill level that they have and what they bring to the table. Did they find their voice, or did they find something near their voice that wasn't, didn't quite catch, you know? And that's the magic of it all. That's why a lot of record industry people walk around saying, do you get it? Do you get it? I don't get it. I don't get it. Do you get it? Like a bunch of freaking chickens. Cause most of them don't really know what they're even listening to. They
right.
They don't know good music from bad, because the only way they define good music, first of all, is album sales, which that means McDonald's is the best restaurant. You
yeah,
know?
It's exactly.
So that's a whole nother argument, but I mean, there's still a lot of magic in it.
Yeah, and there's more great examples like Pearl Jam. So, you know, that's my kind of my jam, right? That's when I really sort of found myself musically, was that time.
Sure.
Right? Like that was right after, kind of right around the Radiohead thing. And I was like a top 40 radio kid, you know what I mean? And the Seattle thing happened, and I bought 10, that record.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? And then I got Soundgarden, Nirvana, Mudhoney, Smashing Pumpkins, you know what I mean? That kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, but in that case, like a random demo of arrangements finds its way from Seattle, Washington to Eddie Vedder in San Diego, California. You know what I mean? And for whatever reason, he listened to it and it resonated with him, and he bangs out lyrics for a couple songs in like 8 hours.
Right.
Puts it on a tape and sends it back to Seattle. And now 20 plus years later, if you look at their body of work, whether you're a fan or not, I mean, clearly this crazy amalgam of coincidences and instances of the universe lining up gives you, you end up with that.
Yeah. And who knows how many fantastic groups didn't come together. You know, that's just like, you know, at different levels, or maybe they last just for a little while. I think about the whole, I'm thinking about Smiths today, but their whole real cycle run was like 5 years.
Yeah.
When you think about it, it's like, wow, all those albums, all that music that influenced happened in such a short period of time. And they, you know, they had their time, then they, as most bands do, finally got sick of each other and, you know, about whatever, who knows, and did their own thing. Yeah, I don't know. It's funny, as I get older, there's still plenty of the magic left in it. And sometimes when you get to look behind the curtain and you understand all that shit works, and you're like, okay, that's monitor mixes, and these are feeding in here, and there's a Xerophone, you know. And you look at, like, okay, I analyze. And there's that band that just blows you away, like somebody like Radiohead. Even knowing all of that stuff, they just knock you over with doing it in a totally different way. And you're just like, wow. You know, that tremolo effect that he used here, I know what that is, but I would never, you know, the way he swept it so it speeded up halfway through, you know, it's just things like that are the magic that is still there.
I think I've actually gotten to a point now where when I go see live bands, I've almost swung all the way back the other way, because I think when I was playing a lot and doing it a lot, I would take a lot of shows for granted. You know, I would go see stuff and I'd be like, ugh, I see this all the time. And you would get those rare Radiohead type circumstances, or like for me, like, Stone Temple Pilots is maybe best live show I've ever seen, just from a, because Robert and Dean DeLeo, who were really the musical drivers behind that, the bass player and the guitar player were brothers, and they write all the musical stuff. And Eric Kretz, which apparently has one speed, mid-tempo, that's all he does. and then Weiland was just a, like, if there was a class on how to be a live front man, like, just take video of him and just put it, you know, like,
take
just
drugs,
do that.
Lots of porn, be super skinny, wear leather, and do that.
Yeah, and have a megaphone, and, you know, that you occasionally put sing into. But anyways, and there were those circumstances. But now it's like, I think because there is so much stuff that's so, it's so produced, and it's so, and maybe I'm a victim of my own knowledge level, because I hear songs and I know what they did to get that. And I'm just like, it feels so not organic. But now it's like almost anytime I see anyone playing an instrument and singing, like, I'm almost automatically engaged, because I'm just like, oh my God, people are still doing this. You know what I mean? And you know what I mean? Like, I'm almost now not awed, but like, I feel very privileged anytime I see anyone playing an instrument and singing and I get to hear it live, because it's like, I feel like there's so much stuff that's put out that's not that at all.
I think bands have gotten better too. Honestly, when I think about, and I play with some, both within and playing on shows with some of the best bands, I mean, just some phenomenal bands that really blew me away. But I think we're just past the point where the technology people are. I'm trying to say they're past the point of just, ooh, look at this cool sound they can do. They're starting to use the technology in a more organic way. And rather than have a cheesy sample of a boing sound, you know, in the back of your thing, you're like, oh, what is that piece of crap? There's some really neat things that people are doing with some of the technology now, finding organic samples and layering them together and putting them out there and starting to use this equipment that's so cheap and you know, everywhere now. That used to be just a handful of studios in the whole world had the access to do these types of things. And all the things you now, I think now it's just beginning the last 5 years. I'm starting to hear like this new upsurgence of young artists that are like, just totally get it at a level that they're not pretenders with this technology. They grew up with iPads, you know what I mean? And they are really integrated that into music in a different way, in a more organic way than has been done before. And I think, partly the technology and some of the plugins sound better, and that makes it sound a little richer. But these kids are taking a mindset about it. And I listen to Album 88 a lot. Just I still, ever since I've been 15,
yeah,
you know, it's
institution.
Still, it just always has a sound of freshness. You know, there's always something fresh you're going to find there. And I'm hearing a lot more of that, which I think we got really stale, in the late 80s. And that was the, all of a sudden you went from Caribbean Queen and Paula Abdul to, you know, Jeremy. And it was just mind-blowing. Or Nirvana.
Although I will listen to some Billy Ocean.
Yeah, nothing wrong with some Billy Ocean, but you know what I'm saying. When that was all you had with these synthetic sounds, the sound of real guitars and somebody really expressing some true emotion rather than this sort of canned emotion, I think that cycle is happening again now.
Yeah, I think you also go through these phases where I will lay a lot of this squarely on the record, you know, the people that are trying to make, you know, radio and record people that are trying to, you know, facilitate this
God
thing.
God bless them at this point.
But I think you also always run into that where something original happens.
Right.
And the public grabs a hold of it.
Sure.
And then the people that need to monetize it try to replicate it.
Yeah.
So much so that then, I mean, this is what happened with like, cause metal, and then you had, you know, the Poison, that deal. And
right.
Then it's like, you had all these dudes that dressed up like chicks and were playing really thin, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the formulaic hair metal
Kramer guitars.
Yeah. Stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and, but then it just got too much because everyone was trying to sign all those bands and, you know, you're putting those bands out because that's what people are buying. And it's not necessarily reflective of the national consciousness. It's just reflective of people going, oh, we can sell this right now. And then it totally burns the fuck out. And people are like, I'm tired of hearing this shit. And then that's when you have, again, outside of just this random guy in San Diego getting a ticket or these guys in Seattle and Nirvana or whatever. But that's when that stuff starts to bubble to the top because people are like, oh, shit, this isn't selling anymore. And so finally somebody gives one of those guys a chance.
Right.
And it's truly original and it's different. And then because then even after that, you got, you know, 6 years after those guys, you started to get, you know, these other bands that are like, how many guys are going to sound like Eddie fucking Vedder?
Silverchair,
like, how many guys
Bush,
are you going to sign like him?
It becomes so inbred. Like, I can't remember how many years it's been now. It's been a long time. But I remember this band's bio is said something to the effect of, we really capture all sounds of music from Nirvana to Soundgarden to Pearl Jam. And it was like, gosh, you're like an inbred, like, pedigree dog that's like nose is too short for it to breathe. Like, no, you know, no wonder nobody wants to, you know, it's so watered down at that point. And then something else comes up and shakes things up, you know. But it's hard to shake things up, I think, now, because you, in the way that, like, we were talking, like, 91, 92, because there was so few outlets then. There was MTV, there was your local radio stations, three or four television stations that may have a dance show or a video show late night. So, but if you came out and made an impact in just five or six areas, you could go from the Nirvana thing, 20 people to 20,000. And I don't know if you could do that now. There's so much, in a good and bad way, there's so much chatter in the system.
Yep.
And anybody with three instruments and a basic Pro Tools program and an autotune program, well, they sound like they can sing in tune. They're playing in time, at least because they quantized everything. And it's hard to find the good music from the bad, like the good players from the bad. And does this player really have anything? Is there really anything there? Or is this sort of crystal sugar spun, woven, very delicate thing that really doesn't translate live? You know, and that's a very different thing. You can make a beautiful studio creation and not have it translate live, and vice versa. A great thing that kills live. And I remember Cowboy Mountain. Sorry, yeah. Fred. You guys were amazing live, but God, in the studio, it was just like, this is terrible. This is not a song. I mean, it's not a great song. It's an okay song. But live, they were so explosive, and he was running around and climbing up. I remember until we were in D.C., you opened up for him, and I was just like, I'd never seen him before. So he was like climbing around the rafters, and he's like, his drummer is, or his guitar player is kicking the kick drum while he's supposed to be playing the drums in his dolphin shorts, and is climbing over the building and just like, it's like, what the hell is going on?
Holly
there?
Actually just went to New Orleans amazing. And saw him. Not see him. She went there to do a story, and she saw Fred when she was there. Yeah. So, but I think he would tell you that. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, he's like, we're a live band. That's the thing. It's like a revival. It's a church revival. That's actually the impetus, whatever. Yeah. And that's what it is. Right. I mean, that's what it's supposed to be. Just like certain things are, there's a really interesting thing. I'll link this in the comments as well that I watched. It was a panel that happened in advance of the Grammys like 2 years ago, and actually Michelle Ray Kaplinger, who was the NARIS president for our region or whatever, they put on these panels, and it was Butch Walker and Dave Cobb.
Okay.
So you know Butch from Cartersville, my hometown, and Marvelous Three, and now he produces Everybody Under the Sun. And Dave Cobb was the Tender Idols, and you know Dave Cobb is now like Uber producer as well. Back in the day when we were doing it, you know, Tender Idols was one of a local band. But they were talking about, again, time and place, and they were talking about sort of the live element. They feel like the live element is coming back to recordings.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of their big things. It's like, can we put you in a room and you pull this off? Like, if we just turn all the mics on and just go, I'm not talking about where we single track everything. Like, can we stick you guys in, mic everyone up?
Yeah.
And let it rip and try to capture some of that ethos that comes from that, right? Because they think that's they feel like that's a quantifiable, measurable thing. It's real.
Oh, it's definitely and, is that stale sound you get in the studio sometimes. You know,
And I agree. But he was saying, but it's also time and place. And one of the examples that that Butch used, which is totally true, is like this is like the anti-calorie is Bohemian Rhapsody. Right, which is again, like I think one of the great rock songs of all time.
True,
that song is not. It's super produced. It has to be because it couldn't be what it was. You can't do that live. I mean, you can, but you can't really reproduce that right live because. But that's not what it's supposed to be, right? Yeah. Like the artist's intent to create that was to create something in that medium where there's tons of overdubs and tons of production and tons of stuff going on because it's a rock opera type thing. But if you try to do it live, if you went to see Queen and that's the only thing they did and they try to do it, I mean, I'm sure it would be okay because it's fucking Queen. But but then if you listen to the track after, the track would blow your doors off because the track is what it is and you can't construct that live.
Yeah.
Right. But it's about intention. And I think people can tell the difference. You know what I'm saying? Like, and also sort of having enough self-awareness to understand what it is. And that's why with Fred, you know, you're totally right. But I think they understand what they are.
Yeah,
and that's why they still can play around New Orleans or whatever and get 5,000 people to turn up and do whatever.
And kill it.
And they probably don't sell a lot of records.
Yeah, no,
I'd
be surprised if they did. But you know, even in something like Bohemian Rhapsody, you can still marry the best of the, I mean, the rhythm section. I don't know how it was recorded. I'm sure pretty aficionados could tell me more. But I'd be curious to see if a lot of those things weren't recorded, so at least the rhythm section together. Or maybe a rhythm section or rhythm guitar together or something like that. That's some elements. But even if that wasn't the case, there's writing a song in the studio and there's writing a song on the road and testing it out in front of people, testing it out even in sound check over a PA, because a simple song will sound huge over PA where a complex one may fall apart or vice versa. I mean, it's a very different thing. It's the first time you step in front of a live mic. It's very different, as you know, than singing in your room.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, this proximity effect comes in. You hear the echo all around. And it works. The songs you play work in a different way than they would. The things that you may kill in your room are awful live, and vice versa. The things that you didn't think were that great really translate live. And a band like that had so much road experience probably had an instinct as to what was going to work. Whereas a lot of bands today start off with, here's my beat, or here's something in the studio, but you start from a different point rather than playing live and seeing what really makes people, real people in a real room, what makes them react.
Yeah.
And that's a very different thing a lot of times what you think.
Yeah, and they talk about in that same thing with Butch and Dave about the idea of the sort of happy mistakes, right? And the things that are I guess technically flaws but need to be in there, right? Like the hairy bits, you know?
Sure.
Like, I'm not talking about if you totally like step on a note, you know what I mean, and just or squeal a vocal note, or you know what I mean, or like rim shot a drum thing, you know what I mean, or something like that. But there are little things that you in older albums and stuff that are in there
because you didn't have the editing. But some of those little imperfections are what made it beautiful. Like, listen to the tambourine in any Rolling Stone song pre 1979. Always out of time.
Yeah, always.
Always lost.
No click tracks somewhere. Going on.
I mean, just a mess.
Nobody sliding it around after the fact in a Pro Tools setup.
Yeah, I mean, isolate Greg Allman's, no, Dwayne Allman's, excuse me. Sorry, everyone. Dwayne Allman's slide guitar at the end of Layla. Just isolate that sick, dead cat sounding thing and see what it sounds like to you. But you put it in the mix with everybody else and the emotion of what was going on, and it's this winsome, you know, but it sounds a bit like a cat being slowly tortured to death. I mean, you know, so it's all perspective and location, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, dude, this has been really fun. I had like a million other things. Like, I wanted to talk about Catfish Jenkins and about Athens in the 90s. And so you need to come back.
You know what? That's all. Those would be great subjects. I would love that. Yeah, we could talk about
Come back.
Athens in the 90s alone was huge.
And that's when we met. And so, you know, and that's when a lot of that, you know, there's just so much cool stuff from back then. And we just didn't talk about any of that. But
part two.
We ended up having this talk about this huge musical journey. So,
and we never did talk about bourbon. We can do that next
time. Yeah, I just broke out some pretty decent bourbon tonight.
Very decent bourbon.
Yeah, so are you... So I'm no Limerick and OVI, but is there a place where you keep this stuff up? Like where?
Yeah, go to my personal Facebook page.
Okay.
Wes or Wes and Luna. I'm playing with Luna.
Oh, she's amazing.
Who is amazing.
Her voice is ridiculous. I mean,
we play together too. There's that energy that just is that magical thing. That it's really nice to have
again. She's got panache.
Yeah.
Like, she's got a lot, like, it. She's got personality, and it comes out.
Confident stage presence.
Yeah.
I mean, and she's just skill. Again, she's done it a million different times with a million different bands, so she's got that level of ability just to walk on any stage. And she's one of those people that has that voice that's just like, wow, you could throw, I recorded her with two or three different mics, and it's like, well, this one sounds a little different, but they all sound great.
It's like the Anitra Hollies of the world. Like the first time I ever heard her sing, I'm like, what is this angel before me?
Right. Yeah. You could put any just piece of junk mic in front of her and it would probably sound great. It'd probably be like the biggest piece of crap, like off an old stereo mic, and it would just sound really cool and authentic and vintage. You know what I mean? It's like, you can't make her sound bad. And it's, some people are like that. But anyway, so go to wesyoakam.com. My website's there. Always has my calendar.
Oh yeah,
and so it's always
and
there.
It's YOAKAM.
Yeah, so Wes Yoakam, but
not WOKIEN.
No, it's not. If you get confused, just look up Dwight Yoakam. It's the same spelling. And that's a subject for next time too.
Remember
probably
one time that's how they had. We played at Cosmopolitan, and we were in like the soundboard and creative loafing, and they just. I've never seen your name misspelled so bad. It's like
I've seen some. Brutalizations of it for sure.
So WESYOAKAM on Facebook or WesYoakam.com. But go out and see it. And if you're gonna go, send me a note and I will meet you out. There's a 18% chance you'll see me rap.
Perfect.
At one of those games.
Maybe 19. Maybe 19 at least.
Absolutely. Well, thanks everybody for listening. This was episode 7 or 8 or something. It's still pretty early. TMIPod.com. Also, you can find me on Twitter at SeanATL.com, at SHAWNATL.com. But everyone have a great week, and we will talk again soon.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming. Until next time, press on.